case will be 08-1099-1100, Systems Division, Tech LLC.
Good morning, may it please the court, I'm Steve Tobin. I'm here on behalf of a Chapter 70 trustee, David P. Lewis, who is actually the second successor of Chapter 7 trustee in this case. As a preliminary matter, I wanted to make clear, because there was an order really on a procedural matter and also a caption of the case that was signed by the clerk, implies that somehow we are here on behalf of Technic. Actually, we are not here on behalf of Technic. We are adverse to both SDI and to Technic and its insiders. And I wanted to make sure, because there was an order on April 1st that referred to the trustee as being Technic. We are not. We are adverse to them. I wanted to first address, if I could, the issue of the court's jurisdiction. In the brief that was filed by SDI, they stated that this court really does no longer have jurisdiction because the California court vacated the order that was on appeal. We believe there's three independent reasons why this court retains jurisdiction. First is, without a remand by this court, I don't believe that the district court had jurisdiction to vacate an order that was on appeal. I don't think that a district court can vacate an order that's on appeal and deprive this court of its appellate jurisdiction, nor can it deprive a litigant of its day in court. As the court is undoubtedly aware, we did not participate in the case in California. We filed an appeal because we felt aggrieved.
I don't understand from a big picture, why are you here? What you want us to do, as I understand it, the only remedy you're seeking from us is what? To say that that order shouldn't have been dismissed? I think that's the exact opposite, right? You actually want us to vacate the original order
that's
subsequently been dismissed.
Here.
So what is your remedy? You want us to do something that the district court already did. They took it out of play.
I understand Your Honor's point. Let me respond to it. First of all, the order was a violation of the automatic stay. It has independent legal significance when it was entered, regardless of its state now, regardless of whether or not the district court can vacate an order that's on appeal without being remanded by this court and take away the trustee's right to have his day in court. So there's a violation of the automatic stay by the entry of the order.
No, if we vacate the order that was entered and this goes back down to the district court, what happens? Because the Northern District of Illinois already reversed it. It seems to me that your trouble is exclusively with what happened in the Northern District of Illinois, which is why you appealed it up to the Seventh Circuit. And look, that seems to be the appropriate avenue for your appeal, but I don't see why you're in our courtroom today.
Okay, there's the Seventh Circuit appeal and this appeal have some overlapping issues, but they're really about different things, and if I can explain. Seventh Circuit appeal deals with the validity of the injunction entered by the bankruptcy court under Section 105 of the Bankruptcy Act. It deals with the scope of the bankruptcy court's jurisdiction under 28 U.S.C. 1334 to issue the injunction. It also deals with the trustee's standing under Cope Refining to prosecute alter ego in piercing the corporate veil claims against the Technic insiders. Bankruptcy is sometimes counterintuitive, but in the Seventh Circuit, under Illinois law,
who are the creditors against the bankrupt entity?
There are
Addition to SDI, what else is out there?
There are two other creditors. There's an insider creditor. Then there was a tort claim that filed a motion to modify the stay to pursue claims against the insurance company. And I suppose if they have a deficiency claim, they'll come back to the bankruptcy court. In addition, Your Honor, there are a host of administrative expenses that are entitled to be paid.
What administrative expenses?
There would be the trustee's fees.
See, that's what this case is all about. This case is all about lawyer greed. You want the 25%. It just baffles me. SDI, legitimate patentee, had a claim. I feel sorry for them being dragged into court here today, and I don't see how we have jurisdiction, and I'm incredibly frustrated at sitting here.
Well, Your Honor, if I can maybe go through the rest of our analysis, Your Honor, I don't believe that the district court's vacation of the underlying order, they had jurisdiction, so the case is still alive before you. Secondly, as I said before, there is an independent violation of the automatic stay, and under this court's decision in Bronson, violations of the automatic stay are not void, they're voidable. We have no avenue of relief other than to come to this court on a direct appeal. We don't think that we can collaterally attack the California District Court's order.
How was the automatic stay violated?
In two ways, Your Honor. First of all, under 362A1, there's an automatic stay that prohibits actions against the debtor. Now, this order basically identified the debtor as one of the parties against which the injunction lay. So that's a violation immediately. But there's the second violation under 362A1 dealing with, quote, the debtor. And as this court has found, the debtor and Kennett, Hamilton, and Holdings are all three of those. Meaning they're one and the same entity. They're one and the same entity legally. And we cited a Fifth Circuit case, the SI acquisition case, that in turn relied upon Robbins, H. Robbins, the Fourth Circuit case, that basically says when you have a special circumstance like this, where there's an alter ego or something akin to that, 362A1 would also apply to the alter egos.
Let me ask you, what's the result if we vacate the order? It goes back and the money's been paid?
Well, Your Honor, I think the Seventh Circuit certainly will deal with the consequences of the settlement. What we want to do, Your Honor, is prevent Judge Carter's order, the district court order of California, from being used against us, and that goes to the collateral consequences.
How can it be used against you if it's not there anymore?
Well, it's being used right now in the Seventh Circuit. We cited to you the portion of the SDI brief that even though the order is vacated, they're using it in the Seventh Circuit, wholesale relying on it to convince the Seventh Circuit that Judge Pallmeyer was correct.
Well, the Seventh Circuit might just say, well, you know, the order's been vacated. That's the end of it. I guess we can't base a decision on an argument that a party's making in a brief.
Well, let me go to a second point. We have an existing claim against SDI in the bankruptcy court for violating the automatic stay. The bankruptcy court has already found that the continuation of the case in California was a violation of the stay. We cited to the appendix at 2755.
What you're saying sort of in a way reinforces what I think Judge Moore was saying in the discussion. Isn't all this stuff to be thrashed out in the bankruptcy proceedings in the Northern District of Illinois and then perhaps in the Seventh Circuit?
Now, I can't attack the California court's order. I mean, I'm citing Celotex for saying the California court couldn't ignore the injunction, collaterally attack the injunction. I can't very well collaterally attack the California court's order in the bankruptcy court. You know, the Sixth Circuit, in the Child versus Hospital Staffing Services case, talked about this in dicta. And normally what happens is that there is a dispute or a disagreement between a state judge or state court and a bankruptcy judge as to the scope of the automatic stay. And normally under supremacy clause, the bankruptcy judge's determination is the one that is controlling. Here we have two federal courts. The bankruptcy court is a unit of the Illinois District Court. So I've got a unit of the Illinois District Court saying the stay does apply. I've got a unit of the California District Court saying the stay doesn't apply. So I can't very well attack, and we didn't attack, the district court's order from California in the Seventh Circuit.
Counsel, are you familiar with our Nestapa versus Delta Scientific Corporation case?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Well, let me read you a quote from it. If an event occurs while a case is pending on appeal that makes it impossible for the court to grant any effectual relief, whatever, to a prevailing party, the appeal must be dismissed as moot. And it goes on to say, the test for mootness is whether the relief sought would, if granted, make a difference to the legal interests of the parties as distinct from their psyches, which might remain deeply engaged with the merits of the litigation.
Yes, Your Honor, that's the general mootness principle. And right. We say that there's three reasons this case is not moot. First, there was no jurisdiction to deprive this court and this trustee of its name in court.
You want us to vacate an order, overturn an order that's been vacated.
At the very least, Your Honor, at the very least, we want an order that of the type that was described by the Supreme Court in the Munsingware case, and I also believe it's consistent with this circuit's jurisprudence on the issue, that the order has no precedential effect. Because there's another collateral.
It's been vacated. The order can't have any precedential effect. It's been vacated, counsel. No court could treat that order as having any precedential effect.
But, Your Honor, it's already being used, both in the Seventh Circuit. We've got another claim.
You're obviously a skillful advocate. I listened to the Seventh Circuit argument. It came up and was discussed that it was vacated. They're not under a disillusion. It's not the case that the appeal went forward and the Seventh Circuit is unaware of the fact that the order has been vacated.
But there's a claim that's pending right now in the bankruptcy court that says...
And I have no doubt you'll make them aware of the fact that the order has been vacated as well.
Your Honor, we will. But what I'm saying is I've got two federal courts that do not, that contradict each other. I can't attack the California court's order directly, other than in this court, which is the only reason that we're here. But there's another collateral consequence.
The order doesn't exist. It was vacated. What effectual relief are we going to give you?
Your Honor, if nothing else, we would like an order from this court saying that it has no precedential effect. As the Munsingware Court, the Supreme Court, and this court also in one of its decisions has said would
be
appropriate.
Is there a court case you can cite to me that indicates that a vacated order does in fact have precedential effect? Because if you could cite me some cases along those lines, then maybe we could grant you effectual relief.
Well, Your Honor, I don't have a particular case today about...
Are you aware of any, even if you can't remember the name?
What I'm saying to you is that there's a claim right now that this affects. And let me explain one other claim that we have against the Technic Insiders. When the trustee reached his settlement agreement with the insiders, they basically repudiated that agreement after Judge Carter entered his order and Judge Pallmeyer followed suit and entered her order. We will have a claim against the insiders for breach of the contract. They have already told me that they are going to be using Judge Carter's order as a defense, as justification, because they were compelled to continue with the payment and the California proceeding. And therefore, they were caught between the bankruptcy court and the California court, and they feel that they will have a justification defense to proceed. And they will have a defense to a breach of contract case. So we do, Your Honor, cite cases about the collateral consequences rule. And whether the order is now vacated, it wasn't vacated because it was wrong. It wasn't vacated because it was improper. It was vacated because it fulfilled its purpose. And I did want to get back to...
Mr. Tobin, you said there were three reasons. You said the district court did not have jurisdiction. The second was that the original order that's now been vacated represented a violation of the automatic stay.
Yes, sir.
What was the third reason?
The third reason is the collateral consequences doctrine. And we believe that there will be collateral consequences because that order is going to be used, it has been used, it will be used, on existing claims and future claims. And at the very least, Your Honor, I think we're entitled to a decision or an indication that the order does not have presidential.
Okay, well, you said that about three or four times.
Sorry,
you got it. Why don't we, you've used almost all of your rebuttal. We'll give you a couple minutes. So.
Thank you, Your
Honor. Mr. O'Connor.
May it please the court. This is my fourth appeal on the same case before this court alone. This case is bleeding my client in attorney's fees. This appeal is clearly frivolous. There's no basis for it whatsoever. I just want to address real fast a couple of misstatements that were made. First of all, there's only one claim. That's my client. If you look at the perfected claims in the bankruptcy court, you'll find my client's name and my client's name alone. Secondly, the trustee on whose behalf this was originally filed has resigned from this case. And I think as the Seventh Circuit, I'm glad you had an opportunity to hear the argument correctly understood, this case is about lawyer greed. This is about these lawyers saying, I don't want that case settling over there. If I can move it from Judge Carter to the bankruptcy jurisdiction, same identical settlement, I can put 25% in my pocket. That's wrong and it's unfair.
How does that work? Why is that the case? You say they can put 25% in their pocket. Why is that?
They have a contingency agreement. That's simple. They get 25% of whatever's collected. So they can move that $4 million out of Judge Carter's courtroom, which they did. And this was a scheme. They went into the bankruptcy court. They got an injunction based on clearly misrepresentations about Judge Carter's decision. Then they used that to stop the settlement that was going on in Judge Carter's courtroom in front of Judge Nagasato. And then they went to the underlying defendants and got the same settlement agreement that we had, and then said, look at this, we've settled the case, Judge. We want the money paid here, and we want our 25%. That's what that was all about. With regard to the automatic stay, that's obviously a completely incorrect analysis of automatic stays. Automatic stays apply only to actions against the bankrupt company or its direct assets. And this automatic stay had nothing to do with that. So I'm almost kind of at a loss for words here because I don't even know how to address why they filed this or what possible basis they have for it. So, what I would ask for, plead on behalf of my clients, is the sanctions be awarded, because this is just not fair to my client. This is clearly a frivolous lawsuit. Just one more attempt to try to find, I think, to try to circumvent the Seventh Circuit. I think what they're hoping is you'll come down with a decision that will be contrary to the Seventh Circuit's decision, and they can somehow use that, I don't know how, to still force this settlement in the manager's report. And that's wrong. That's just not wrong. Okay. I think I have a little time left. Thank you very much.
If I could, I wanted to respond just briefly. The injunction was not procured by any misrepresentation. The injunction was entered on June 26th. The Scrivener's error, Your Honor, is explained fully and is documented in note 12 of our opening brief and note 4 of our reply brief. What happened is when we submitted the order after the injunction was entered to conform to the court's order, we combined inadvertently two paragraphs, where the other order only had the one paragraph. It was a misattribution. It was purely innocent, but the court had already ruled. And I wanted to just say that. As far as the compensation arrangement, Your Honor, there was no money in the estate. We were called in basically on an emergency basis by the trustee. We came in 2 years after the case was filed. We negotiated our arrangement with the U.S. Trustee's office, which is the Department of Justice. There was no money in the estate to pay, so we didn't know. And then what we did is we entered the motion and continued it for 5 weeks. So there was a second hearing. SDI did not appear at that hearing. We brought to the court's attention the objection that SDI had filed, and SDI, did not show up. The judge overruled it. But I do want to get back to Judge Shaw's question about the violation of the automatic stay. We talked about 362A1 with respect to the debtor and the alter egos. There's also a 362A3 violation, and that's dealing with property of the estate. One claim that the debtors have under Coker Pining in the Seventh Circuit is we have a right to pierce the corporate veil of the debtor and to seek recovery for all of the liabilities of the estate from the insiders, including the $4 million that was awarded to SDI, for which they filed a claim in the bankruptcy case. So when the alter egos satisfied their judgment and paid only SDI and paid no money to the trustee, our claim is extinguished. They can't be made to pay twice. So because there was a joint liability, our claim was extinguished when the payment was made. So that's the second aspect of the stay violation. So there's 362A1 and 362A3. The third thing, Your Honor, is that I think under Celotex, under this court's decision in Alistair, you cannot collaterally attack injunctions. So I think that the original order that was entered by Judge Carter did violate the Celotex rule. And in that regard, I think we're also entitled to say that the order was void when it was entered. Under Bronson, the jurisprudence here is that the order would only be void.
Your time has expired, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you.